Welcome to the Deadcast.
Our special segment tonight is a fresh look at the series of murders in Atlanta.
Aaron Jackson Jr. was among the youngest, only 9 years old.
Funeral services were held today for 15-year-old Joseph Bell, the 24th victim in Atlanta's child slayings.
It's just a tragic, horrible nightmare that we're going through.
In Atlanta, another body was discovered today, the 23rd. Larry Rogers, a 21-year-old black man, last seen getting into a green car near his home, March 30th.
Ruby Jeter was 14. We're not in a position today to make an arrest. Timothy Hill, 13. Patrick Baltazar, 11.
There are cases in history that have gone on much longer than this has.
For almost 2 years, the bodies have kept coming out of Atlanta's rivers and woods. The killer? There was a handful of sketches, no one the same, no one certain to be the person police want.
She also claims that the killer, who is black and used to live in Miami, says that he delivered some of the children to whites to be killed.
They don't know how or where or even how many of the black victims may have been killed by the same person. At Police Task Force Headquarters, there are 27 faces on the wall, 26 murdered, one missing.
Wayne Williams' attorneys asked the court for any prosecution evidence that might clear him. The prosecution said there was none. Judge Clarence Cooper agreed to study everything the prosecution had. 2 months later, after personally reviewing files of the Special Police Task Force, Judge Cooper turned over volumes of material to the defense. Nowhere was there any mention of an investigation into possible Ku Klux Klan involvement in the murders. But 9 months before, a handful of Atlanta police officers and GBI agents had begun a top-secret Klan probe known as the 8100 file. According to the file, then-GBI Director Phil Peters ordered it kept secret, even from the task force, for fear that, quote, if the intelligence leaked out, it would possibly cause a race riot, end quote.
A half dozen of the cases may be isolated, unrelated homicides. The victims found near home, killed perhaps by family or friends. But somewhere in the city of Atlanta, there is a person who has killed 15 or 20 boys and young men.
But my theory, the person is not abducted, not kidnapped, not snatched off the street at that particular time, but is willingly going with somebody for something, at least at the instance they get in the car.
Larry Marshall, convicted in the past of robbery, forgery, and running a house of prostitution, lived in this house in the backyard of downtown Atlanta. For several weeks, undercover FBI agents and police have been watching the house and this one a few blocks away. Both reportedly have been hangouts for young teenage boys who police think came here to exchange sex with men for money.
Ruby Jeter was 14.
Children he's seen in the neighborhood. Among them, 13-year-old Timothy Hill, 11-year-old Patrick Baltazar, and 15-year-old Joseph Bell. 62-year-old Tom Terrell, who has been convicted 4 times of sex offenses. On March 12th, the day before he was reported missing, Timothy Hill spent the night at Terrell's house.
He was here on 12th, but he's supposed to come back on the 13th, and that was my birthday.
He didn't come back. I didn't see him, and haven't seen him since.
Last week, Timothy Hill's body was recovered from a river. He was murder victim number 21. Tom Terrell is being questioned by police. Lee Brown, head of the special task force, denies that sex is a significant factor in the child murders.
Hello, and welcome to the premiere episode of Season 2 of The Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling independent author Ian Totten. And as always, I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take a look at some pretty big cases this season, which, as I'm sure you can tell from the trailer at the beginning of the show, is going to start with the highly controversial Atlanta child murders, which took place in the late 70s into the early 1980s in Atlanta, Georgia. However, before I get into all of that, I'd like to thank everyone for the feedback that I have received on Season 1. Received a lot of private messages on social media, on various sites, from people letting me know what they thought of the show, and not only that, but also suggesting cases, which I am grateful for as well. Before we kick this mother off, few plugs as always, although some of them have changed. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Ian Totten Author. Don't look for me on Twitter. The overlords there have decided that I am an undesirable and removed my account for reasons they never made plain to me. You can also find all of my books on Amazon and Kindle, with one of them currently on Audible. Just search for Ian Totten on Amazon. You can also find me on Patreon at Ian Totten Author. There is stuff going up there very, very soon. In fact, it may be up by the time that this is released. I've been having some problems interfacing with Patreon's platform. Few plugs for friends of the show. Firstly, if you're into politics and have what I consider to be an open mind to listening to both sides of the spectrum, have open discussions and debates, I'd like to recommend the new show called Malice Toward None, which is hosted by John Culkin and Richie Caldwell, where they take a political topic every week and each one of them discusses it from their point of view without getting all worked up and vicious towards each other, which is actually kind of nice to hear. Again, the show is called Malice Towards None, and you can find it on pretty much every podcast platform from Apple, I believe it's on Stitcher, Podbean, pretty much all your regular places that you're going to find a podcast. Another friend of the show is a woman by the name of Janine Mijoseph, who wrestled professionally under the name of Mad Maxine. She has a new fiction book out. It is a fictional retelling of her life and career in professional wrestling called The Chronicles of Mad Maxine. I'm just going to read you one quick blurb that I found on the book. It's an exciting, fast-paced, fun novel that you don't have to be a wrestling fan to enjoy. The Chronicles of Mad Maxine tells the fictionalized story of a young woman reporter who infiltrates closed society, clashes with the KKK, and runs the roads of America, all in search of the story. This book is available on Amazon, Kindle, as well as audiobook. I highly recommend it, so go out and get it. Now the plugs for the week are out of the way. Get yourself something to drink, find a comfy chair, sit down, chill out, close your eyes. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. So what has come to be known as the Atlanta child murders began, or so the official story says, on July 21st, 1979, when 14-year-old Edward Smith disappeared. Now, I worded it that way on purpose because there's an official narrative from the city of Atlanta that really doesn't fit with the facts at all. So much so that there is just so much with this case that the city of Atlanta, in their absolute ineptitude, completely glanced over and or ignored. And you're going to see that as we go further into this case. We're going to be looking at a number of things that are not in the mainstream narrative. What do I mean by mainstream narrative? I mean the narrative that has been put out by the Atlanta Police Department, the city of Atlanta, as well as the media organizations within Atlanta. Because they would have you believe that the task force that ended up getting formed as a result of these murders was, you know, really on top of things and, you know, much better than they actually were. There's a lot of evidence that contradicts that statement and proves that the Atlanta task force was one of the most inept in the history of criminal investigations. And by inept, I'm talking on the level of the Yorkshire Ripper task force, which had numerous chances to catch Peter Sutcliffe, but bungled at every turn. The Atlanta task force ignored mountains of evidence over the course of their investigation and really did an awful job of their investigation. But I'm getting ahead of myself. 1970s Atlanta was a city that was poised to break out as the shining jewel within southern cities. There was a lot of diversity within Atlanta, as opposed to a lot of other cities in the south. People who held the old mentality of Atlanta being the, you know, the stronghold of the Confederacy had given way to a much more open-minded, liberal-leaning mindset. There was, you know, blacks and whites in Atlanta mixed freely and had done so for quite a while. Atlanta had been a hotbed of the civil rights movement, and the city leaders, you know, were fully aware of this fact. Atlanta was one of the first, if not the first, cities in the South to have a black mayor in Maynard Jackson. And Jackson constantly preached about, you know, making Atlanta a destination for various people from around the world, whether they were in the entertainment industry, in industry itself, all forms of different industries. Jackson and his cronies were really trying to set Atlanta up to be the New York City of the South. Like most major cities, Atlanta did have a fairly high violent crime rate, and this was something that the mayor and everyone involved with him would try and downplay and just not discuss if they could avoid it. So while they're, you know, trying to build this new Atlanta, at the same time, Jackson is trying to do away with the old Jim Crow era cronyism that had been, you know, embedded in Atlanta society for decades. One of them was the Atlanta Chief of Police, a man by the name of John Inman, who had pretty much weathered the storm in Atlanta from the early 1970s, despite a progressive ideal to get him out of his position and move it towards, you know, what they saw as having a more bureaucratic, well-run police department. What this all accomplished, however, was that very little was done in the way of combating or tracking crime. because the city leaders in the early to mid 70s were battling with Inman. A lot of crimes went unreported, a lot of it went unsolved. And that is something important to our story because, again, there's this narrative that the, you know, Atlanta child killings, you know, were really the first of this type of thing in Atlanta, and that's just not true. You can look at statistics if you dig up old newspaper articles from places like newspapers.com. You'll see that that is, in fact, not true. There was a fairly high mortality rate among the children of Atlanta prior to the start of the murders. That is not to say, however, that the Atlanta murders were not, you know, committed by a single person or group of people. There is evidence to suggest that, in fact, you know, was the act of, you know, what we today term serial murders, although personally I'm not certain that actually applies in this case. The gist of what I'm saying, however, is that Atlanta's police department was ill-prepared to deal with such a string of killings because of its own internal infighting. A perfect example of that is when Maynard Jackson was eventually elected as the mayor of Atlanta. He ended up ousting John Inman from the position through legal maneuvers with the court. And everything really just went to hell, to the point that the chief of police position was actually abolished in Atlanta for a period of time. And an individual was put in as head of public safety who, although extremely unqualified, basically was put there to oversee the police and fire departments. And a number of the individuals who were initially put into these roles really did a lot of grandstanding. This is not to speak ill of the civil rights movement, but a number of the people first put into the position had been part of the civil rights movement and had become almost addicted to the celebrity that they had gained because of that. So, as opposed to actually doing things to better the police and fire departments in Atlanta, a lot of what they did was to get their names in the papers or on television. Coupled with all of this, you had the still prevalent issue of police brutality among the black community in Atlanta. Anyone who's watched the news in the last year knows that police brutality is still an issue in this country. It was worse back in the 70s and 80s in Atlanta because the people really did not have a voice. Even with a black mayor, black city councilman, all of that stuff, the police continued to just run as they always had, and they looked at the individuals who they were in actuality there to serve and to protect as a burden upon them. So anytime that something happened, you know, you called the cops on somebody because they broke into your house, well, you might end up getting arrested for something just because that's the way things work. That is the setting in Atlanta. As these murders began in early July of 1979, when 14-year-old Edward Hope Smith, who's also known as Teddy, disappeared. And 4 days after Edward disappeared, another 14-year-old by the name of Alfred Evans disappeared. it says something about the city of Atlanta that the police did not take these disappearances seriously at all. In fact, the children were thought of as runaways, because back during that time period, any time a child disappeared, that's what they were listed as, was a runaway. Unless you, as the parent or a concerned individual, could really prove something diabolical had happened, the police just, you know, kids are being kids. They leave home, they run away all the time. That's much different from our society today, although unfortunately there are police precincts that still take that tact. You couple those facts with the high morality rate among Atlanta's youths, and you can begin to see why the police did not fully, you know, grasp what was taking place in their city, and why they didn't even really notice or put anything together when the bodies were discovered. On July 28, 1979, a woman was walking along Nisky Lake Road in southwest Atlanta. The woman was out looking for bottles and cans and various other things that she could redeem for money, when she spied a human ankle caught in the vines of kind of a wooded ravine on the side of the road. And she contacted the police, who came out, and they discovered the body of 14-year-old Edward Hope Smith. He had been shot once with a .22 caliber weapon. Smith was found dressed entirely in black. Now, Evans lived not far from the location that his body had been found. However, what the police found next should have sent up warning flares to them, but it did not. Not far away from where Smith's body was found, the body of Alfred Evans was discovered. He too was clad all in black, although there were no visible signs as to what may have killed him. Evans lived in another part of town, so the fact that his body was discovered there was pretty far from his house. Was odd, but again, the police did not put two and two together. In fact, the way they looked at it was that they had two separate homicides that were unrelated in any way, shape, or form, other than the fact that they were found in the same general area. Alfred had gone missing on July 25th. After receiving permission to go uptown to a local movie theater and watch a kung fu film, what is known is that a neighbor had given Evans a ride for a short distance to Eastlake Boulevard and Glenwood Road, at which point Evans was going to get on a bus that would take him to his destination. One private investigator, a former police officer in both Kentucky and Atlanta by the name of Chet Dettlinger, whose work is the primary source of our investigation today, has been able to link a number of the murder victims with one another. And as we go along, you're going to see these connections, how these young men's lives interconnected with each other. What Dettlinger surmises is that both Evans and Smith encountered each other at some point during that day. And I know you're probably thinking, wait a minute, you said that these boys' disappearances were separated by 4 days, and there is a reason for that. They lived in different counties, and Evans County the missing persons department was closed when his mother contacted them and would not open again until the following Monday. See, these boys both disappeared on a Friday. When Alfred Evans did not return that evening, his mother was naturally worried. But she figured, you know, he's a 14-year-old boy. He's probably out running around with his friends. I bet he'll be home when I get up in the morning. However, the next morning, that Saturday, when she woke up, her son still was not home. So she called the police department, only to be told that because she lived in DeKalb County, it was the Atlanta Police Department's responsibility to find her son. The way Atlanta works is it's separated into multiple counties, and because of this, there are different police departments within the city of Atlanta itself. The best way to, I can liken this to, you know, another major city would be along the lines of, you know, New York City, where certain precincts only cover specific areas of the city. In Atlanta, though, the police departments, each one was separate from the other, and as we know from looking at other cases, back then, departments were not apt to share information among each other. This is something that later would make it much more difficult for the police to track the killer. At any rate, when Evan's mother finally got in contact with the Atlanta Police Department, she was informed that the missing persons department was closed until Monday and that she would have to wait. Once Alfred Evans' mother was able to put in a report, very little was done about it. Again, this was the time period kids that vanished were mostly seen as runaways. Fast forwarding to when the bodies of Smith and Edwards were found, very quickly they were able to identify Smith via dental records. However, Alfred Evans' body would not be identified for quite some time, and despite the fact that it somewhat resembled Evans in that the clothing the body was wearing matched descriptions of what he was wearing, the police did not, make the leap of faith and state that it was in fact Alfred Evans. And the reason for this is that, according to police reports, the dental charts of Alfred Evans did not match those of the body. Something that we will see quite a bit later was, in fact, a misnomer, that is to say, an untruth. After the two bodies had been removed, the police continued looking in the area, just, you know, the idea of there's two here, maybe there's another, but they did not find any. The police interviewed a lot of different witnesses, and what they were able to put together was that Smith and Evans had been at a pot party on County Line Road, which is not far from Nisky Lake Road. And the story that came out but has never been verified is that Smith and Evans ended up getting into an argument with Evans shooting Smith, and that friends of Smith had beaten up Evans, with one of them actually strangling Evans. And I bring this up because initially the two young boys were listed as being drug-related deaths. They were not in any way thought of being part of a pattern or anything like that. And as for Evans' body, his mother refused to come down to the morgue and identify him, which, being a parent myself, I can imagine that not being something that you're too keen to do, or maybe even willing to do, because who wants to go see a body that might possibly be their own child? on September 9th of 1979. Another 14-year-old, this one named Milton Harvey, left his home to go pay a bill at the Citizens Bank for his mother. What is known is that he did in fact make it to the bank before heading home. Milton was riding a bicycle, which was later found on Sandy Creek Road between the bank that he had gone to and a large drive-in movie theater. Now, the area that the bicycle was found in was fairly desolate. In fact, at the time that Milton went missing, Sandy Creek Road was nothing more than a dirt road that ran along the outer perimeter of Charlie Brown Airport. Just a quick aside, it's not named after the Peanuts character, it's some local politician from Atlanta's past. October 22nd, 1979, about a month after Harvey had disappeared, 9-year-old Yusuf Bell went missing. Yusuf had gone to a store to buy snuff for a neighbor of his. Now, the store was located on McDaniel Street in Atlanta, not far from his home. And as with many of these cases, there were witnesses who said that they saw the young boy. A Bell was seen near the intersection of McDaniel and Fulton Street getting into a blue car shortly before he disappeared. Again, his mother put in a missing persons report, and as you're gonna see a lot in this story, there was no follow-up. Even once the city of Atlanta realized that they actually had a problem on their hands, police didn't come back and talk to the mother or any of the neighbors or anything. They just did a quick, if they did anything at all, that is. They just did a quick talking to with the parents or whoever, and that was it. There was no follow-through on any of this. Yusuf Bell was just, you know, consigned to a file and forgotten. And if you take away anything from this series I'm doing on the Atlanta child murders, it's I want you to take these boys' identities with you, because a lot of them have been forgotten, as there are certain cases associated with this that have been singled out much more than others. In the various podcasts that cover this case, HBO put out a really questionable documentary about the Atlanta child murders that wasn't really well researched. They missed a lot of stuff because they had a very specific race-related narrative that they wanted to push, which was basically that white people had committed these murders. Which may be true, but there is not enough evidence to support that particular theory. Although that documentary pretty much left the watcher feeling as though these murders were only done because of race, which I don't believe they were, but we'll get into that. In early November, a body was found out on Red Wine Road in the Atlanta suburb of East Point. Again, it was a fairly desolate stretch of road, and his body was found quite a long ways away from where his bicycle had been left. Harvey's body was found in something of a trash dump. You can find file footage online of where they found his body. You can see old refrigerators and washing machines, garbage, that kind of stuff. He had been buried underneath a pile of debris out there. Again, murder was in the paper. It may have been mentioned on television, but it really, you know, slipped underneath everyone's radar. The same with Yousef El. His body was found on November 8th. And a couple interesting things before I get into where Yousef was found. His mother stated originally that the woman who saw Yousef getting into the blue car recognized the driver as Yousef's father. This woman apparently knew Yousef. She knew his mother. She knew his father, John. Nothing ever came of that information. Again, the police took it, logged it, let it be. Again, on November 8th, a janitor forced his way into the abandoned E.P. Johnson Elementary School on Fulton and Martin Streets around 9:30 in the morning. The man, who at the time was 39 years old, was named John Henry Ty. He stated that he had gone into the building because he had to go to the bathroom. Here's the interesting part, however. Yousef's body wasn't just lying out in the middle of the floor or, you know, in a room. It was actually stuffed underneath the floor inside something that's called a maintenance trap, which is a hole in the concrete floor designed to provide access to the pipes. Again, just something to think about. That's really odd that this janitor would go into the building and think to go into this maintenance hole for whatever reason. The police suspected that Yousef had been carried into the school, as, again, the school was abandoned, the floors were filthy, yet the young boy's feet were absolutely clean. Further interest about this case is that the police did actually interview Yousef's father, who said that, you know, he would be found unharmed. Well, his girlfriend claimed she'd experienced a psychic revelation wherein Yousef's body would be found buried under concrete. Not stuff I'm making up. This is from police files, things that were never followed up on, even after Yousef's body was found buried under concrete. The father was a person of interest in the case, although nothing ever came of it. I can't say whether or not he had anything or his girlfriend to do with Yousef's disappearance, nor am I here to implicate that. I just find it suspicious that his girlfriend made that statement to police. It's in official police records, and then he was found under the concrete floor in an abandoned school. Couple of names that are going to get mentioned over the course of this series. You're not going to find them on the official Atlanta Missing and Murdered list, but I am going to mention them because they do fit the pattern that Chet Dettlinger was able to establish in these cases. Again, they're murders that the Atlanta Police Department really didn't take seriously and didn't investigate. Because as you'll see, the list, which is a bone of contention in this case, was the only thing that the task force that was eventually set up focused on. The name wasn't on the list, it didn't really matter. And I think, personally, that's a shame. But it's what the police department did, and it's not conjecture, it's fact. There wouldn't be another case that was linked to the Atlanta child murders until March of 1980. The first of these took place on March 4th of 1980 when 12-year-old Angel Lanier, the first female victim that has been linked to the case is yet disappeared from her home around 4 p.m. Angel was last seen wearing a jean jacket as well as jean pants. Angel and her mother, Venus, had only been in the Atlanta area for about 2 months at the time of Angel's disappearance. They originally were from Chicago and had fled the city because Angel's mother had gotten into some scrapes with the law concerning controlled substances. Now, apparently Angel's mother was concerned with the way her daughter was acting, as the young 12-year-old was beginning to act much more mature than her age belied, and they lived near an army base. Her mother was further distressed when an older man who lived nearby began expressing an interest in her daughter. All of this kind of stuff was playing in Venus Taylor's mind on the afternoon of March 10th, when Venus noticed a commotion in the wooded lot across from their house on Campbellton Road. She ran across the street to find out what was going on. Strangely enough, this all took place around 4 p.m., which is roughly the time that Angel disappeared. What Venus found upon going across the street was that a young woman had been found with her hands tied behind her back, and she had been fastened to a tree with a pair of women's underwear that were not her own stuffed down her throat. An electrical cord had been wrapped tightly around the young girl's body, and Venus immediately recognized the body as belonging to her missing 12-year-old daughter. Upon letting the police know this, she had been told that they didn't know who it was, but naturally, Angel's body was quickly identified at the morgue. Of note from the autopsy was that Angel had apparently had some form of sexual encounter prior to her death. Whether this was consensual or forced, however, is not known. Something else of note concerning the case of Angel is that in the same week her body was found, the bodies of two other young girls were found murdered, although this received next to no coverage in the news media beside a single piece in one of the papers. On March 11th, this is the day after Angel's body was found, another young boy vanished. It was 10-year-old Jeffrey Mathis. Jeffrey had left the house to go to the Star service station, which was roughly 2 blocks from his house, in order to buy a pack of cigarettes for his mother. My, how times have changed. This was around 7:30 at night. Jeffrey was witnessed getting into a blue car on Gordon Street. This was witnessed by another young boy who Jeffrey had actually been embroiled in some sort of a feud with. In fact, the two of them had fought the previous day on the 10th, and then that day, the 11th. And the young man witnessed the car as it drove down Gordon Street before making a U-turn and heading back toward Jeffrey, at which point it pulled over next to a fire hydrant, and Jeffrey got into the car. So, it's important here to take note that this is the second time, at least, that witnesses have seen a blue car in the vicinity where a child has gone missing. This is also the second time that the victim willingly got into said blue car. In Jeffrey's case, a young girl who was inside of a laundromat and witnessed it said that he didn't appear to have been forced into the car, but instead had climbed in of his own free will. It was the last time that Jeffrey Lamar Mathis was seen alive. We're gonna end this week's episode with the disappearance of Jeffrey Mathis. I'm ending it here because things really start to pick up in this case from this point on, and there's so much ground to cover. I don't want to do either the case or the victims a disservice by trying to cram as many of them in to a short period of time as possible. I want to, you know, give them the respect they deserve by covering their disappearances, murders, and discoveries more than just a few seconds of me speaking. So we will dive back in next week, where the people of Atlanta, at least a few of them, start to notice that something is going on with the children. That is it for the Deathcast this week. I hope you enjoyed our first sojourn into the Atlanta child murders cases, and I'm hoping that you look forward to hearing more about it over the next few weeks. If you did enjoy this show, please consider subscribing to it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Podbean, anywhere that you can get podcasts. I'm all the platforms. If sitting there with headphones in your ears is not your thing, you can also find me on YouTube at Ian Totten Author. All of my shows go up there in video format. If you've already subscribed to the show, I encourage you to please leave a 5-star review on whatever podcast app it is that you use. They really do help the show. Until next week, stay morbid.
Welcome to the Deathcast.